To the LSC. Welcome to the LSC Cities program Thursday evening series. Many of you are familiar with our series. Tonight we have Kelvin Campbell with us. Kelvin is one of the founding directors of Urban Initiatives, again a practice many of you will have heard of. It's a practice that specializes in urban design, in master planning, in regeneration, urban development. Kelvin has been in this world for some 25 years now, so he's very seasoned at it. He's been doing projects internationally, but a lot of the projects have been specifically in the UK itself. And what's especially interesting about the practice is not only that it has quite a multidisciplinary approach to the projects, but that they have also made that leap out of the sort of pragmatics of practice into the area of research. And that's really some of the issues that he's going to touch upon tonight are much more issues where they've taken the time to be thoughtful about some of those, you know, very, very pressing topics that certainly all of us in the Cities program spend a lot of time sort of pulling our hair out about and grappling with, and certainly many of the practitioners in the room will be familiar with these issues. And this is what, as you can see, is being called re-urbanism. This is actually a talk which is very much based on a publication that came out in 2002 where Kelvin was the co-author. This is something which I think is very interesting to all of us as practitioners, because it really starts to make that bridge between the kind of the sort of intellectual and intellectual ambitions that we all have when we approach a project and the pragmatics that we often tend to get bogged down with. So this is really, I sort of invite you to luxuriate with Kelvin in being able to sort of stand back and look at images that don't immediately necessarily say, I'm a master plan, but actually are about our everyday life in the city. I believe that Kelvin's going to start off with a short film, and then he'll take you through his presentation, and there will be some time for questions and discussion afterwards. Thank you very much, Kelvin.
Thank you. Can I say what a pleasure it is to be talking at such a creative and exciting event as this? Let's talk about what's being achieved, shall we? Thanks to this government, people across the land are enjoying a better quality of existence. There's more jobs now, wider opportunities, joyful lives, and a greater number of trees. In the past, we knew how to create sustainable communities. Places like Chester, York, Bath, they stood the test of time. But somehow we lost our way. Urban planners started to believe that cities could be built according to a set of rules. When we came to power, we knew we had to make some changes. So we made a new set of rules. We decided that cities had to be vibrant, mixed-use, sustainable. This is the one that we term actually new. And at the time, they want a brighter future for our children and for our children's children. They need a greater understanding, more trees, a true sense of purpose. You see, the people who are living in developments need to live in vibrant, mixed-use, sustainable developments. Leading Revolution is a whole new generation industry of very creative professionals, encouraged and supported by its government. And this government lesson is starting to have a very real effect on people's lives. Soon, every town will have a mixed-use event. Every city will boast cutting-edge retail facilities and trees. Yeah, lots of trees. The future is in our hands. A vibrant tomorrow is at our feet, and the strength and will to realize this lies in our hearts. We must design a better tomorrow, don't we? Because humanity is counting on us.
Sorry, just a quick extract from a film we're making on reurbanism at the moment. It's the opening chapter, and I don't know how many of you went to the Delivering Sustainability Community Summit in Manchester. Hands up, anyone? Can we go for it? Jonathan, I saw you there. It was like a volume house builders trade fair. And in fact, what we're finding since we wrote reurbanism is that all these words, these great words we have, are all getting diminished. Everything has sustainable on it. Everything has community. Everything has delivering on it. And in many ways, the great idea that I think Ricky Burdett, who was involved with the writing of the Towards Urban Renaissance, all those great ideas have been lost. I think they've been lost because the words have been diminished. So we're focusing on a film that really talks about the words, and I'll come to this towards the end. I'll give you an indication of where we are in the middle as well. But firstly tonight, Rob Cowan's here, my co-author. Where's Rob? Okay, sorry, Rob, I'm doing the talking tonight, but Rob, you can just answer some of the questions. The book Reurbanism was issued at the last Urban Summit, and it was issued as a challenge to the Urban Summit. And effectively it was signed by, I think, about 60 people, two of which are here tonight, I see, Jonathan Smales and who's the other one? Catherine. Catherine, your name's on it as well. it was actually a group of people saying, look, we bought the Urban Renaissance T-shirt. We like the idea. We think it's a brilliant idea. But let's be serious about it. And effectively what this polemic was about saying, how do we really move forward and bring about the sort of the fundamental changes? But at the same time, can we really consider a new philosophy by which we move forward in the design and shaping of our cities? And it wasn't aimed at the government. It was aimed actually at us. It was aimed at the professionals, the people who teach professionals, those people who commission professionals as well. So it was aimed at those people, effectively saying, it's us who have to change in many ways. What do we mean by urbanism? I went to a meeting recently at the RIBA where I think they spent about 3 days trying to discuss the word urbanism. But in many ways, what we're talking about is the pursuit of urbanity. It's the point at which society collectively and physically comes together in some place for the betterment of people. So urbanity is a very high-order term for us. It actually means something which is much more beyond the standard practice of how we design and master plan places. It's about an emotional, spiritual, an artistic approach as well to towns and cities. We also set ourselves about 4 or 5 objectives when we wrote Reurbanism. Firstly, we said, it is a new way of thinking about cities. As I said, it was aimed primarily at the urban specialists. But it also didn't want to become a manifesto, didn't want to become another theory. We called it an attitude, okay? An ethos, not a formula. We didn't want to come up with a formula. We wanted to set the agenda for a new debate, rather than laying down a set of rules and being quite dogmatic about what those rules were. We also said, we needed fundamental changes. We didn't want more tinkering. We went through a process over the past 2 years, the change of the planning system. And effectively, all that's happened is, you know, deck chairs have been moved on the Titanic, as far as I'm concerned. Things have changed. In fact, the words have changed, but actually the practice and the process hasn't changed at all. And also, I suppose, as a much more of a sort of romantic idea, could we get together and draft a new charter for urbanism? The last time a charter was drafted was Siam, the Athens Charter. And effectively, it established the way in which we moved forward for almost 50 years. But actually, all of those pseudosciences that effectively drove that last charter have all gone away. And we're living in a vacuum where we have no real philosophy or no idea about how we move forward. This idea of beauty as well came up as a key concern. So in many ways, reurbanism was also about a plea for humanism in designing cities. We'd given science a chance for 50 years. The traffic engineer had shaped our towns and cities using scientific dogma. Could we actually look at artistic principles rather than the standard practice that we've used? But I think more importantly, to put the citizen at the center of public life, not the systems of the city. I think, finally... Okay. Is that better? Right. Finally, it was also said, you know, we also said we were serious about the urban renaissance. We actually believed in it. As I said before, we bought the T-shirt. We were a bit scared to take off the jumper. So this idea of saying, well, okay, let's all get together. Let's create this popular front for cities, and let's move forward. And invited people with the same passion to join as well. It had two aims. The first, the higher order aim. What happens if we could think about a new way of looking at cities? But secondly, about 10 things we could seriously do and probably move forward collectively as professionals, as institutions, in changing the place if we were serious about the urban renaissance. The new way of thinking, as I said, was the main aim was about this charter. But the important thing was that the document really was about setting the agenda for writing that charter rather than writing that charter If we went out and wrote it, it would almost be like the new urbanist charter. It would be coming from a few people rather than from collective thinking. We also recognize that, as I mentioned earlier, cities are victims of outdated thinking. All the reductionist processes that shaped all the decisions that make cities have got very little relevance today. And in fact, if you look at what reductionism is defined as, it's really about an economy and explanation, which is completely contradictory to the idea of complex urban environments. So reductionism and complex cities are fundamentally opposed. And some of those things have filtered through, and we can see the effects of that. And still today, the fact that the street is still not recognized as the main integrator, it's still about movement only, it's still driven by the scientific dogma. Interesting, when we looked at the Siam Charter, it also said it saw itself as a moral rather than a stylistic charter. So could we also do the same thing? Could there be a strong moral edge to the charter we wrote for urbanism? Where's urban design now? I think its origins maybe 25 years ago, Rob? About 25 years ago, the urban design group convened and defined the word urban design. It was really about finding the gap or mending the gaps between the different professions. And I think the big problem is that it mustn't become the polyfiller profession. It mustn't become the thing that effectively fills the gaps between other professionals. It has to sort of step up and become a lot more mainstream. But actually today, is it just about sticking plasters on the planning system? Is it just about the friendly face of the planning system? I've often referred to it as kind of the Windows interface on a PC. Underneath, we have a system that's flawed, but we've got something that's quite friendly on top. And also, urban design now, is it still just about a philosophical debate between Krier and Kohlhaas? I mean, they're the two ends of the pole. We don't seem to have any debate around the middle ground. Everything seems to focus around these two ends. And also, the government has clearly bought into the idea of the new urbanist movement. John Prescott went to Seaside. Did you see the movie? I forgot what the name of the movie is. What's this movie again? Rob? What's that? Oh, The Truman Show, set at Seaside. And this idea that what we need is more seasides, I just find that absolutely ludicrous. And of course, at the back, there's this constant debate and this constant fight between the new urbanist and this radical movement Rim Koolhaas spearheads. Actually, at the end of the day, neither are that relevant, because both of them use absolute reason to justify where they're going. And Vaclav Havel said this quite clearly. It's about time we recognize that absolute reason is not a valid way of moving forward. So what we're seriously saying is that we need this new philosophy. Rationalism is dead. Okay, we need to find something which is far more complex. The second principle, the second idea based on that urbanism is based on, was these essential changes that we could focus on. And we're actually saying that places are still rendered stillborn by some of those things that are in the system. In other words, the virus that's in the system, we need to get rid of that virus if we're serious about moving forward. Okay, the bugs are deep. And unless we deal with these, they'll frustrate this idea of the urban renaissance. And I'll take you through 10 of these. There's probably a lot more, but these are the ones we focused on at the time. Firstly, cities are victims of specialisms. Okay? Good urbanism needs urbanists with cities in their blood. And we're finding this more and more rarely. We're finding people who have a strong commitment to cities, the passion for cities. I'm sure it exists in an organization like this. But too often, the urban design course is a bolt-on to a group of people whose undergraduate education is effectively polluted. So you're spending a lot of time working with people to try and make them more passionate about places. Can we learn from the medical profession? A profession like ours that doesn't train the general practitioner and actually focus directly on the heart specialists or the brain surgeons from day one is absolutely ludicrous. Now, it doesn't actually mean that the urban designer is the general practitioner, but certainly a lot of us need to come from a background where we understand the general practitioner philosophy. Perhaps the urban designer moves to become the physician, the person who specializes in the whole body. And that's really where the role of the urban designer should be in the future. The other thing is, in complex urban environments, we can't have these narrow stereotypes, the landscape architect, the traffic engineer, the urban designer. We really have to move across the board and try and create this blend, this mix of different things. I heard an analogy the other night that the professions are like extruded... Rob, you were there. Some extruded... strings coming out of, I think we were at the Cube, wasn't it? And they had these sort of holes in the wall, and there was this extruded idea. And actually, what we're trying to do afterwards, once these people come out, we try and knit them into something called an urban designer. And that's absolutely wrong. I had this kind of this fear of these incredibly badly knitted jumpers that come together. And really, it's not about knitting together people afterwards. It's about getting to people before to make sure that they're influenced and they think across the board in the best possible way. The Egan Report has come out, and the Egan Report has said we have an incredible scarcity. We certainly feel it in our practice. Good people who understand cities, good people who have a passion for cities as well. And I think we're at that point now where all these other agendas are working in our favor, but we really don't have the skills to deal with them. And in fact, it's an incredible vacuum. We tried to count the other day the last remaining urban theorists in the world, the people who are thinking about it, and there are very few of them. Second point, the cities are victims of the planning system. The planning system is anti-city. Its basis was in the new town planning movement. Its basis wasn't in complex urban environments. Its basis was in separation, segregation, and it's actually it's still the basis of how we moved forward in the design of cities. It's still a quasi-legal process. It's nothing about physical planning. Unless we move the planning system to a far more physical-based system, it'll only become another set of words, and those words will be debated in planning inquiries forever. I mean, it's interesting, the London Plan, it was defined as the spatial strategy for London. Well, there's nothing spatial in it at all. You know, it is not a physical plan. It's actually another set of words. So we're suggesting every place should have a physical plan. Every place should define itself and how it moves forward, if it's serious about the Renaissance. The only debate that seems to take place, and this is an extract from a planning journal last week, is the last remaining physical thing that the planner has, the strategic gap. Okay? The only physical thing they have in their toolkit. They have a road widening program, but no one builds roads anymore. Okay? So they have a strategic gap. And that's the only physical thing that the planning system has. Third point, cities are victims of bigness. Okay? Big pictures need big walls. This idea of big this, big that. And in fact, in many ways, we've lost the art of subdivision. We've lost this ability to break things down into small bite-sized chunks. We lost this ability to make a city of 1,000 designers. And you only have to look at schemes, I know Fred, you probably know this one quite well, Elephant and Castle, this collection of things, big architecture, big buildings, big plans, the same sort of standard formula. And really what Elephant and Castle needed was a subdivision plan to break it down into lots of bite-sized chunks to move it forward. It didn't need a bigger picture than Elephant and Castle at the moment. Cities are victims of quick fixes, are largely driven by political expediency or driven by funding programs where this idea is to deliver quickly. But actually cities have evolved over hundreds of years, and this idea of being able to fix something in such a short space of time is absolutely ludicrous. The work that took place on the Yorkshire Renaissance Towns Program really took a 25-year view, and it's quite important if we see places in terms of 25 years. The London Docklands is almost 25 years, so if you think about that in the time scale, it's not a long time in the lifespan of cities, but you almost need to have that long-term view. 5 years, 7 years is not enough. Far-sighted visions, this idea of looking ahead, is going to be absolutely crucial if we're going to move forward. And that actually means that political vision is important to the process as well. We've actually seen programs changing regularly. We've seen almost every year we've seen a move from city challenge to capital challenge to UDCs to URCs, and no one knows where they are. And all these things are short-term. So unless we put in place a long-term framework, we're really not going to hit our targets. We hear the mantra all the time, outputs, outputs, outputs. And that's the cost, bad urbanism, short-term decisions. You know, jobs, put a drive in McDonald's in it, keep 7 jobs in an area, at least it meets some sort of target. Flog the site quickly, move ahead. And we can see this all the time, and I think we experience it on a daily basis, aren't we, David? The other thing is recognizing the importance of mess. Why do we have to fix everything? When is a place designated a regeneration area? Shouldn't we be keeping under the arches? Shouldn't we be putting them into cotton wool and keeping them? Because they're almost the essential first building block of the economic process. This idea of constantly want to fix all those bits that are functioning. They might be functioning in the grey economy, but they're part of the economy of towns and cities. So this idea of recognizing that we have to sort of mothball places and stay away. In fact, turning a blind eye is probably sometimes the best strategy in places. Cities are victims of unchallenged truths. There's probably thousands of unchallenged truths, but the one that sort of springs to mind today is that the private sector can't build cities. Okay? They never have. The private sector can build resorts like seasides, but the private sector cannot build place or town. They can build buildings, but they really don't have the interest to create town. And in many ways, unless we recognize this, unless we recognize that the role of the public sector is crucial to delivering change, the classic one is affordable housing. You know, affordable housing in the Southeast is only delivered through private sector involvement. In other words, the private sector contributing to affordable housing. I don't know how we reached this point, but we got this, and this is the only way of delivering social and affordable housing. Up in the housing market renewal areas, you can get government funding. This idea that we can actually build our growth areas by coercing house builders into their so-called sustainable, deliverable, mixed-use communities is absolutely ludicrous. Complexity. It's the one thing that we must understand. Complexity in cities is such an important factor. It says over here, the system acquires collective properties of its own, a life of its own, you might say, through those elements clashing or accommodating with one another. What this talks about is the necessity of conflict or the necessity of interaction. In many ways, all our rules are designed to manage out these conflicts or eradicate these conflicts. I'm thinking classically a place like Milton Keynes, where you can drive from your business park to your mock Tudor house, and you never once have to say, after you, mate. You never have to once deal with a fellow community member because of the rules that have been set up in terms of movement. Cities are victims of the rule book. I'm sure we can talk about this. There's a lecture in this. But effectively, things that are also affecting the way in which we design places at the moment. Health and safety rules, the Disability Act, the impact that has on streets. The National House Building Regulations that say you can't pull out a tree within 4 meters of a building, otherwise you won't get insured. The insurance process that basically classifies you as a risk in terms of anything you do. So you almost have to be heterosexual, live in a castle at the top of a hill to actually get insured, okay, to put yourself in that low-risk category. And that's also shaping, because that's the way in which people design places. They design it to minimize insurance risk. Good urbanism is designed by goals and principles. Okay, we need to choose. We need to move away from standard approaches. This is a lovely statement, and a very good book for those people who are interested. Philip Howe, The Death of Common Sense. Rationalism, that bright dream of figuring out everything in advance and setting forth precisely as a centralized regulatory system. Obsessed with certainty, we see almost nothing. And in fact, it's our instinct to regulate. It's our instinct to write the rules. And in fact, we really have to make sure that we're writing the rules for the right reasons. There's nothing wrong with having a set of rules, but that tends to be so overarching that we really don't introduce this idea of local choice or local response. And maybe we should be moving towards much more performance criteria. Can we define places in terms of how we want them to perform? Do we actually need such empirical rules? I think, it's in our instinct, it's in our society to look at parameters all the time, the old 21-meter back-to-back rule. You know, all those sorts of things that have shaped and made places what they are. The BRE lighting standards, rights to light criteria, tree preservation orders, all those sorts of things. For Jonathan, cities are victims of one-eye environmentalism. I know not you, Jonathan, but this idea that landscape structure is more important than urban structure. You know, if London conformed to a plan that retained landscape structure, it wouldn't exist. Okay? It wouldn't have covered over its rivers. At its extreme, it flattens the top of a mountain in Hong Kong and pushes it into the river, okay, in the pursuit of compact urban form. And compactness is the best form, is the best type of environmentalism. In fact, good urbanism is good environmentalism. Cities are victims of the unenlightened client. Too often, I think we find ourselves doing public consultation exercises with people who really have lost the sense of the possible. They really understand what's in their gift to achieve or to deliver. And unless we actually get people understanding what it is to be good citizens and actually demand good places, and of course, once again, have good civic leadership, we're also not going to achieve the urban renaissance. Those great places that we all speak about were defined by single-minded people who had a very strong active will. This idea that you sit around the table and collectively from your stakeholder group come up with a decision is also ludicrous. Unless those people actually understand the sense of the possible. And this is the classic problem we have as urban designers, where permeability is a noble concern that we have, but it means rat running for a local community. And you can actually sit and talk about the best possible place, but it always comes down to traffic at the end of the day. There's always the traffic engineer asking 20 or 30 other questions. So this idea of actually having bold and brave civic leaders who make long-term decisions in the collective interest of the community must be the way we go. And that actually means building capacity, a lot more capacity for people, spending time with them in advance. Certainly the Renaissance program, the Yorkshire Renaissance program, focused on this idea of building a good solid base of civic leaderships who were informed, who could make decisions, and who could take over when we went away. And I think unless we start with this idea up front that people do matter and people do have a voice, but also people do need to understand the implications of decisions in the collective interest of a community, we also won't achieve the Renaissance. Great quote from Men in Black, why the big secret? People are smart, they can handle it. A person is smart, people are dumb, panicky, and dangerous animals, and you know it. Okay. We've seen it all before. And actually what we really are talking about is this idea of citizenship. You know, people who really believe, you know, a community that believes and has a passion for place as well. Not a passion just for their own personal place, but for their community, their town, their city. Ninth point, cities are victims of the lost street. You can see it all the time. Local authority doesn't want to adopt a street. So these big lumps of development that happen all the way along the river with these private streets, all of them, CCTV camera, you know, locking in these places. And this idea that public streets, we can't build. It's almost impossible to build a new main street today. So the statement, every inch of the living street must be fought for, claim more, concede nothing. The street is the integrator, it's the first point that society comes together. The corner is the first point that we join with one another. Then the last point, cities are victims of the wow factor. Good urbanism derives from the essential order of a place. Not everything has to be wow. Okay. There's a fantastic article written by Alain de Botton, I think it was in Architecture Today, which talks about the specialist and the ordinary. Okay. You actually need special places, but special places must be reflected against the ordinary. It's the backdrop. The reason that Peckham Library is a good building, it's reflected against the ordinariness of Peckham. And we seem to want to make everything special. Everything seems to want to become an expo project. These are some of the quotes from Alain de Botton's article. I think it was Architecture Today last week, if I'm not mistaken. We excel at one horse, but we cannot make the fabric against which our icons should stand. There's another issue that's emerging, is the use of design codes as well. It's interesting, we always go back and we say, well, design codes work for Georgian architecture, but we had Georgian architecture at the time. You know, that was the thing we did have. So there's a big debate about whether design codes will really achieve what we want in terms of design. I think the focus should be much more on getting a much stronger awareness amongst the architects about what it is to be good urbanists, not just good product designers. Rob's quote from the Dictionary of Urbanism, sort of plug for Rob's latest book that's coming out when, Rob?
Next week.
Fantastic. Well, how many? I don't know, there's about 5,000 words or something. I don't know how many you got in there. How much is that?
6,500.
6,500 words, definitions of words. The wow factor, a lovely explanation. Pray, sir, by what name do you distinguish this character when a person walks around the grounds for the second time? You know, wow is fantastic when you see it once, but what does it mean the second time around? So reurbanism really points a finger at others, but it also points fingers at ourselves. We can all change. We're all part of this system. We all advise clients. We all do different things. We want everyone to join. Hopefully the film will put us up on a slightly different gear. I'll give you some extracts from some of the film. We're focusing very much on words. I mean, words is the kind of thing that's being demeaned at the moment. So the whole thing is about a collection of words and how they're used. It focuses on this idea that cities are complex and they can't be reduced to a series of buzzwords. We can't just have this constant strap line like back to basics or creating sustainable communities, a sort of subtext to these other words, when they mean nothing. And of course they're demeaned by a lot of other people. So some examples of some of the adverts in the new vibrant, the washing powder type approach. Instant ready-made cities, sustainable. Mixed use, a right dog's dinner. And community, whole grain, living spaces. It's constantly shifting. We're working on it all the time. We welcome any ideas. We welcome other people to come forward and help as well. The film also needs some additional funding. Jules from Squint Opera. Is Jules here tonight? No? Jules is trying to get additional funding. We have got support from Yorkshire Forward and from Kent County Council. So welcome the debate. Thank you very much.
From the audience. Hi, I'm Shripriya. You mentioned in the initial part of the presentation about London Plan and commenting that it doesn't really have anything spatial component in it at all. But I fear that this comment is somewhere contradictory to the whole presentation, in a sense that we have seen what it means to have spatial planning both at the level of new towns, entire towns being laid, and also parts of it which was planned, like the case of Stepney, in the post-war period. So I would like to know what you actually meant when you said need for spatial planning, because somewhere down the line, the rest of the points that you made for need for more freer choices to be made kind of restricts this.
We can switch that off, actually. Sorry. Just switch it off. Yeah. I think I wasn't trying to be. I tried to make a contradiction. I was trying to make a play on two or three things there. Firstly, the word spatial. Okay. And spatial to me is physical. Spatial means we're talking quantum, we're talking some sort of physical form. My understanding is that a lot of that was in the London plan, but once lawyers get hold of these things, they tend to sort of eradicate them. They become too prescriptive or too definitive. I think what I'm saying is we actually need a spatial plan. We need a defined plan. We can't rely on laissez-faire. We can't rely on a traditional development where, you know, development is kind of a flanking movement around the next edge of town. It must be put in the context of a much wider plan, much wider strategy. So what I'm actually saying is we need a physical plan for London. I don't believe the London plan delivered a physical plan. I think it delivered more words. It delivered a better plan or a better idea, but it wasn't a physical plan.
Trying to be perverse in seeking them out, but it's where one can argue credibly, I think, and appropriately for development frameworks, master plans, and so on. But they can be very dangerous things in the wrong hands.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, one's pleading for, making a plea rather, fleeing. Sorry, I just invented a word for re-urbanism, I think. One can make a plea for great civic leadership. But if it's not there, and you've got those not very great civic leaders making bad plans, yeah, you can get the worst of all worlds. How do we square that particular thing?
I think I'm agreeing with you, and the problem is that we have bad plans because we have bad civic leaders. It's interesting at the Sustainable Community Summit, they wheeled in someone from Chicago to tell us what they're doing in Chicago. Why aren't we wheeling in someone locally? Maybe they don't exist, and you probably know, having experienced the problem, Jonathan, the great civic leaders are few and far between. The kind of guys who deliver places like Manchester, or when Fred was running Southwark, and those sort of people who are making changes were important. I think what I'm saying is that unless we do have an informed civic leadership that actually thinks in the collective interest of the community, not just sits at the back of the room at a public consultation meeting, engages the responsible of the stakeholders and then makes a decision. And I think in many ways we've been replacing civic leadership with consultation. And I think that's wrong.
I have a question, actually, while people are thinking of other questions. I think certainly very sympathetic to what you've put forth this evening and the kind of, knot that we've gotten ourselves in over the years. And I can see that what you're proposing and that what you and Rob have put together, certainly in the book, is something that rightly so takes a long-term vision. But day to day, I mean, you'll go back to the office tomorrow, maybe tonight, maybe not tonight, I hope. We all go to work and we are faced with clients, with plans, with local authorities, with the rule books that you're talking about. How does one then get on? Because what you're talking about is a much longer term sort of almost a kind of, re-education and review of the place of the city in all of our minds, from school children up, in a sense. Those new civic leaders are not going to be the people necessarily who are the civic leaders today, and they wake up one morning and sort of, have an epiphany. So how do we get on in our day-to-day lives to try and work towards this?
I think what we said is we said the debate hasn't begun yet. We don't seem to have the forum for debate. And I think that's the frustrating part in some ways. I don't know how many people started the modern movement. Couldn't have been that many. A bunch of guys who seem to sort of come together at a particular point in time and define a way forward. You know, it's that collective thinking, the strength of the idea, the power of the idea that's needed. And I think what we're saying is we need to have this debate. The debate has to happen. The debate has to happen to influence the way in which we're educating people, the way in which we as professionals are working on a daily basis. We're all victims of our professions. We go back to our professional institutes, and that defines us in some ways. And I think that's the problem. We might have the Urban Design Alliance, but we revert to type when we go back home. You're absolutely right.
We have a question back here.
It seems to me that the problem is political. We need long-term plans. Require a manifesto that's going to be perhaps outside of the scope of a five-year plan and the time of that present government. This the sort of regeneration program and reurbanism program we want to put in is going to require a tremendous amount of money. And where is how are we going to finance it? This is what concerns me. How is this new urbanism going to be financed? Most politicians are really don't want to put up taxes, and it seems to me the only way you can finance the new urban ideals is to put up taxes.
I can't answer that question about the need to put up taxes, but money gets spent every day on things. We're just saying let's find a way of refocusing that money. I think that's the plea. In fact, I don't believe it is political. I think for the first time we have our planning policy guidance, we have our funding regimes largely up to speed with where we want to go. I think in many ways it's the professions that are lagging behind. The professions are part of the problem. And I think that's why we actually aimed this one largely at the professions and the people who teach them. That's where the real bottleneck exists at the moment. You can have this debate with politicians nowadays. I think in many ways the film's a bit of a hard knock at politicians. But in many ways, they gave us the word urban renaissance. They gave us PPG1, they gave us PPG3, PPG6. I mean, some fantastic bits of guidance. So this isn't about knocking government. This is about saying, we love your words, but let's make sure we're serious about those words. Let's make sure that they don't get diminished by house builders or diminished by the grey people who are in the audience clapping, you know, who go back and call themselves Renaissance managers, and all they become are, you know, dare I say it, planners in a different guise. You know, they don't really subscribe to the ideals of Renaissance. They've just got a word in front of their name, and that's all it means. So what we're saying is, let's get serious about it. I mean, Renaissance as a concept is a brilliant idea. It means rebirth. It actually means having an intellectual approach as well. We don't seem to have the intellectual approach for how we move forward. We have the political will. We have an enormous amount of goodwill in terms of shifting towards cities. I think also the market's shifting us towards cities anyway. If you look at the demographics, it's happening despite us rather than because of us. So what I'm saying is the money's there. Let's just find a different way of doing it. I'd love to have more money. We'd all love to have more money. If you want to put up more taxes, I don't have a view on that.
Chairman.
And Jairaj, I was trying to understand the points that you were making, and you made a point on it's important to have mess in the cities.
Yeah.
And then you made another point on the great urbanism depends on the essential order and comprehensive urban form. I was just trying to understand from a practitioner's point of view, how would you explain these two? How much of a mess and how much of the order, and what urban form idea are we striving towards?
Okay, I think the two are not directly linked, but when I spoke about the importance of mess, I think it was trying to say that there are parts of our cities that are actually essential bits of the urban economy. And I think of classically under the arches, you know, the sort of those dodgy things that happen under the arches. But actually they're a vital part of society. They represent the first rung on the economic ladder. And actually by pitching the first rung of the economic ladder at some sort of trading estate, we don't allow people to come into the system. And real successful cities have those messy parts, and let's recognize them, let's value them. I think that's the point that was made there. The second point that was made on essential order It's that point about giving the providing the skeleton for the ordinary. I think it's probably what I'm using Alain Botton's words, is actually what we need is to create that framework within which the ordinary happens, and that enables the icons to happen at the same time. And that's what our job is. Our job is about creating order, about actually creating order in places, allocating things, defining things, putting urban structure into places. That's our job. That's our job as urban designers.
Allison, and then Fred.
You mentioned that this debate is just beginning to happen, but it seems as though this debate can happen because you have public and institutional support for the debate to happen. You have funding, you have growth of cities, but in parts of the world that don't have the kind of growth that Western cities are seeing right now and don't have public support for good urban design, where can this debate lead them, and can it actually have an influence outside of the sphere of London, Barcelona, New York, Chicago?
Yeah, I think we were quite deliberate in our focus, and our focus was on towns and cities. You know, we weren't about focusing on lower order things. We were focusing on places that were complex. And I think the difference between a first world city and a third world city is having enough money to overcome the structural problems of the place. And that's the essential difference. In other words, we can choose to get in our car in a first world city and drive 40 miles to our jobs, but we can't do that in a third world city. And in fact, the ecosystem of a third world city becomes far more complex because of that. It becomes far more reliant in terms of locality. A lot of the problems we face in first world cities are trying to effectively spend our money, you know, to try and move ourselves around in complex ways. I don't know what we learn about other places. Our focus was very much on what was happening here. What was happening here in terms of education? What is happening here in terms of the planning system? What is happening here in terms of the way our environmental approach? All those sorts of things. So it was very much focused on the UK. We weren't attempting to make it wider than that.
Thank you.
I'm really glad I came because I haven't kept up with what's going on. I haven't read Reurbanism, and I'm so pleased that someone is jumping right in the center and having a radical middle view. And here you are claiming to occupy the middle space in this whole area. But I have a deep worry about it, to be honest. Trying to put it into words, I think what you're attempting to do is to say you want to have a debate, but setting out 10 statements which are really forcing an answer out of it. And because you believe your starting point is that cities are wonderful, and you often have repeated points about cities which are great, means that you're not really exploring the mechanisms and the ways that things function without assuming that the city is the contributor towards that. And I know this is part of the lecture series for Jane Jacobs, and there is an alternative argument that maybe people chose to leave the places which they were in before. And maybe those economic systems which made Jane Jacobs' wonderful city have disappeared. And my concern about your requesting a debate is that you're saying that the group who is going to come and have that debate with you have already agreed that the city is wonderful, have already agreed, for example, that a street is the only solution to it. Our first encounters are on a corner, and nothing else could be. And until a corner was invented, no one spoke to each other. Which actually won't open up the discussion to really understanding the way things are going. And when you finally come and say that the problem is the problem of the professionals, I'm not sure that I'm with you at all. Because I think whatever we mean by cities, they're pretty dynamic, they're pretty amazing. And you know, if there weren't any professionals around, there'd still be cities.
I agree with your last point. I think I made that point by saying is that cities are happening, or places, or things are happening despite us, not because of us. I think we did start, you know, wholeheartedly, you know, wearing our hearts on our sleeves. We have a passion for cities. So we're saying those people who have a passion for cities, come and join us. Those people who have a passion for making great streets and great things, come and join us. If you don't, go and join the other group. Go and join the Milton Keynes group, or go and join the... I think that we were actually saying that cities are a fact. Cities are part of our everyday life. As I said, cities represent the highest order of society coming together. What's wrong with that? We'll have debates about whether the street should be called a street or not. We've had that debate constantly in the Renaissance program, certainly with Will Alsop. But they are facts. So we're actually saying that's where we want to be. We're also saying, you know, things are happening despite professionals. The other thing that's actually happening as well is the changing demographics, and we see this on a daily basis. The fastest creation of households is in single family units. Those people are urbanizing, those people are staying as young married until they're 30, 35, and they're all having a fundamental effect on this re-urbanizing process that's happening.
You spoke about a sort of gap in the education of city planners. Do you think you have any suggestions of how that can be bridged, and what kind of education should be provided, whether it should be provided by you as professionals or some sort of extension of that? What's your answer to that?
BA urbanism, quite simply, or BSc urbanism, we want to call it an undergraduate urbanism course. After which you're going to specialize in being a building designer or a public space designer or a process person. But all of us must come to the table with the same underlying language. If you sit with five professionals around a table, each of them come to the table with different value systems, each of them are driven by their own agendas, and it's very difficult. The expectation that if you put five professionals around the table, you have a common view. Well, you don't. You have five different views that come together at a particular point in time. And quite often, the urban designer is the mediator in this process. I prefer to have a team that all sings from the same hymn sheet. And I'm sure a lot of people that are here tonight are people who came from quite defined backgrounds. I think David is a traffic engineer, but now is an urbanist. Okay? They focus on streets. They employ people from the LSE. Now, and this is actually what's happening with those people who do have this ability to think outside their box. Most people who do urban design or members of the urban design group are people who are thinking outside the box all the time, and they effectively jump ship from their professions. They want to do something different.
Thanks. Richard Rogers wrote in an article in The Guardian a while ago that the problem with good urban design is that all the decisions made have to be agreed by a myriad of quangos. And how do you propose that these great civic leaders that you want to appear, how are they going to cope with all the quangos that are involved in sort of new good urban developments and getting sort of good agreement for good urban design?
I can't agree with you. I don't know how many quangos there are on the Thames Gateway. It's actually frightening to see all the acronyms down there. I think what we're saying is that we've been replacing these quangos we've been replacing these quangos where we should be putting in place the great civic leaders. We've been putting these quangos in place. And it can't continue like this. I don't believe that they're contributing in any way to a positive place. I think we need to, that's a clear area that we need to change. And I agree with Richard Rogers entirely there. The great decision maker who brings people along, is what we really want.
The comment you just made about all urbanists singing from the same hymn sheet, I feel kind of frightening because I guess as long as that originates from the same place, it seems to counteract what you're saying is great about a city. Is that you get all of these different views coming and different perspectives and different levels of, I guess, different points of view coming in to make a city. And to try to create an even base from which all of our urbanists come seems to kind of counter that. But also you run the risk of doing exactly what Siam did or doing, as long as you get everyone signing up to this one agenda, ethos, whatever, you buy into all of the faults that come with that.
I think it's a very good point that. And it probably picks up what Fred said. It depends who's involved in drafting it. It really has to be a lot wider than a single view. And that's why we were determined to not make this a manifesto, but to actually say, we don't know what it is, but let's talk about it. There's lots of things we can do, but let's start talking about it. When I say come to the table with a common view, what I'm actually talking about is coming to the table with a common philosophy. And I think the problem about the professions is they're all driven by different philosophies. The surveyor that's driven by maximizing value on a site versus the architect who's increasingly the product designer in the process versus the landscape architect who has his own particular view versus the planner who's somewhere schooled between Marxism and Leninism but doesn't quite know exactly where he's coming from. And I think all these people come together and effectively can't communicate with one another. They appear to communicate, but they don't. And I think we need a vehicle to communicate. I think that's the point I was trying to make there. Rather than a clone, dumbed-down version of a single view.
There was a question in the front. Did you still?
Yeah. In order to for essentially John Prescott to get to the next stage in his sort of Southeast plan, he obviously has to use words to sell his certain picture. And this is obviously a political reason that he uses certain words. But I mean, how are people going to sort of fit into their heads what these other communities are going to be like? I mean, obviously John Prescott has to use a certain sort of vocabulary in selling his idea. So I mean, are you advocating a different sort of reality to what he's advocating, or is it just a different use of words?
No, I think we love what he's saying. The trouble is that it's the audience that's hearing it. And if you were at the Sustainable Communities Summit, you would have seen vinyl sidings houses called sustainable community units or something. You know? It would have been what's heard by the audience and how the audience translates. That's why you saw that idea of sustainable and cheap flashed on. Yeah. The idea was saying that what someone's saying is not being understood, okay, because it's been thrown back in a completely different way. So we're saying, love the words, this is not a knock against government, this is saying, fantastic, we like what you're saying. But we're saying, well, let's get serious about it, let's actually seriously believe what we say when we use this idea of sustainable mixed use, whatever it is, let's be serious about those words, and let's make those words mean something, not just marketing brands to volume house builders.
Do you have any examples of good practice and of, if not plans, at least projects that you think exemplify the kind of attitude that you were describing? Because as some other people have said, when I hear this talk about, you know, we need great civic leaders with long-term vision and a plan, and we need to re-educate ourselves and other people so that we come to the table with the same philosophy, I tend to get scared. So I think if you could provide at least some concrete example of something that you think works or has worked, something that you could or we could get our hands on and discuss as if not, again, if not a plan, at least a project, you know, a concrete modification of the urban environment that you think exemplifies the virtues that you so rightly are expounding here.
I can only say that we got this incredible tradition of town making and city building in this country that we seem to forget about all the time. You know, we seem to sort of forget that incredible passion and power that existed to make places. You know, you can be accused of being a historicist if you all of a sudden lapse back into great Georgian architecture or the great Victorian suburbs that were built or whatever, you know, whatever example you want to spring to mind. The problem about best practice is that whenever you go and look for it, you'll find it partially. You'll never find the whole story. You'll find the great civic leader that brought about the regeneration of Barcelona. We've heard about people like this. We've come across one or two civic leaders up in Yorkshire who really are willing to step outside the box and make long-term decisions. You know, but the products of their wares hasn't come out yet. You know, it's difficult to say who they exist and what they've delivered. So I think what we're saying is whenever we look at these examples exist around us all the time. You know, we just got to look for them. I don't say there's any magic answer to saying this is the perfect scheme, but there are elements of it in almost everything we see around us every day.
Perhaps I'll be cheeky and ask the last question, which is very much tied to this earlier question, which is, what is the forum then for debate? Because it seems from what you've said that to escape this trap of words, and it's something you know that one recognizes very much. I mean, I'm sure my students are tired of hearing me say, if you say, let's design a beautiful public space, you know, and you're saying that to five people, they'll all have some five different things in their heads.
Yeah.
So ultimately, what is the forum for that debate if it is to be a true debate? Does it not involve physical, sort of living, breathing pieces of city around which we can start to have that debate, whether they, you know, already are in existence or somehow are being brought into existence?
I mean, I don't know where this forum for debate is going to happen. I mean, that's what I clearly don't know. I think we were hoping when we did the first book there'd be more people wanting to step forward. In fact, it has become a bit like a dodgy Eastern European film. You know, there's a lot of a lot of people who've bought the book and have written back and said, "Oh, we'd love to get involved." You know, they tend to come from further afield, quite frankly. Rob, is that quite true? I mean, what's your view of the response so far? Yeah, have you got any idea? Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot there, but.
You don't know who's responding to what, or where influences are coming from, or what the latest words that are being coined are meaning. So, I think sometimes you've got to let the debate develop, and throw things in that just seem the right thing to say at a particular time, and then. Pick it up a couple of years later and try and say something that seems to respond to that particular moment. And the debate certainly changed, I think, dramatically, even between the two urban summits. The first one was the urban summit, the second one was the deliverable sustainable communities summit, and the fog of words is sort of enveloping us. I think the just one last comment. I'd say the planning system is at a turning point. I think there are two ways forward. One is the prospect of continuing mind-numbing bureaucracy, and the other route leads to total breakdown. And I just hope we have the wisdom to choose the right path. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, I suppose that's a fitting line on which to end. I want to thank you very much, and. Hopefully we will all participate in the debate in one way or another. Yep. I also want to bring to people's attention that Urban Initiatives and the re-urbanists have kindly brought some CDs and booklets that you can pick up on your way out of the room over at the table by the door there. So thank you very much, Calvin.
Thank you.